squirmed and tried to get off his knees. Kilbert pushed him back again.
"Kill me, and you lose your gold. Kill me, and you won't find the Welshman."
"You're wrong on both counts. You'll yield that information when I ask for it," said Blackstone, with the implied threat of torture. "How much did you pay him for delivering Routier's to you?" he said, turning to the Countess. She waved a hand at the bailiff, who opened the linen chest and hauled out a small sack of coin.
"This is what he arrived with, and I gave him more."
"Bitch!" Cade hissed with disbelief.
"William, you're a fool. You are easily betrayed by your own kind. Once your men failed in their ambush, and we were told that we might be attacked, it wasn't difficult to discover its hiding place. I paid the man who betrayed you well."
The bailiff dropped the sack at Blackstone's feet. The Countess made a slight gesture towards the sack of gold and the bound prisoner.
"Take the gold, and take him. He means nothing to me."
"Whore!"
Cade yelled, and earned a cuff across the head from Kilbert.
"That's no way to address a noble lady," said Kilbert.
He smiled at the Countess and dipped his head in respect. Countess Catherine barely took a breath after being interrupted by Cade's insult.
"King John and the Dauphin will hear of what you do here. Be it on your own head."
"This whore bitch!"
Kilbert struck him again. Cade spat blood, but he shook the blow away as if it were nothing more than a wasp sting.
"She took me to her bed. She will take any man to her bed."
"Not any man. Only those I choose," she answered coolly and sat down,
easing a crease from her dress. Kilbert smiled and bowed slightly.
"I am at your service, Countess. A decent bath and a clean linen shirt, and I am no longer the ruffian you see before you."
Cade laughed derisively.
"She's a bitch on heat who goes for your throat. Watch it doesn't get cut. She took your false monk to her bed, the young one. She fucked him into manhood."
Countess Catherine Duval showed no expression, other than to stare expressionless at Blackstone and Kilbert.
"Where is he?"
said Blackstone to Cade, as Kilbert grabbed a handful of his hair and yanked back his head. Cade spat bloody phlegm at Blackstone and laughed for a second before Kilbert gave him more than a wasp-sting blow. He fell back, barely conscious.
"When you attacked us, Cade had him taken to the cellars," said the Countess.
Blackstone grabbed Cade, hauling him to his feet.
"You," he said, pointing at the bailiff. "You show the way."
The bailiff received a nod of consent from the Countess, and then quickly moved to open the doors. Sir Gilbert Kilbert is a veteran knight who has long served Edward of England. "He stays," says Blackstone. "Gilbert, if her guards make any move against you, call for the men outside, and kill her." The doors closed behind Blackstone. Kilbert helped himself to more wine, and this time took a glass for the seductive woman, whose eyes smiled at him.
"Would you?" she asked.
"Regretfully, yes," said Kilbert. She took the glass.
"You have killed many women?"
"Hundreds," he said.
"You are a liar, Sir Gilbert,"
she said, raising the glass to her lips. "Only about some things," he said. "Not about the beauty of women, never that. But as insurance against such an event as your early death, I drink to your health. And beauty."
"I accept," she said.
She raised a hand, and with the slightest of gestures, commanded the two sworn men to step away across the room.
"You have the temperament of a gentleman," she said, softly.
An intimate compliment, whose tone of voice she did not wish her keepers to witness.
"I am versed in love and war, madam." "Well versed?" she asked, glancing at him over the rim of her glass.
"Experience, hard won," he answered.
"And my well-being might be in your hands?"
"Should that occasion arise, it is possible that I could persuade Thomas Blackstone not to cause any harm to befall you. He is a man of insolence and intemperate ways, a legend at war feared across the country. He even tried to kill the King of France once. Violence is not even second nature to him. It is his first."
"Then I am at your mercy," she said. "Is that the truth?"
"It would appear so."
"Truthfully?"
"I seldom lie, my lady. Better that a man be known by his words as well as his actions." Kildare stood in front of the fire, warming his back. It was a good enough reason to step closer to her. She smelled of flower fragrance, and he imagined breathing it deeper, were his face resting on her naked flesh.
"Sir Gilbert, would a woman who fell under your charm allow you the freedom to wander like a travelling minstrel?" she probed. "Would such a man as yourself not have a family? Children, perhaps?"
"No woman has yet caged my heart, Countess. Then as for children, well, there are none that I know of."
"Perhaps you do not possess the passion or the ability to do what is necessary when holding a naked mistress in your arms," she taunted him. "Your beard is slight. Perhaps the state of the hay suggests whether the pitchfork is any good. There seems little more than the fuzz that ladies have in certain places."
"Given that we play the game of truth or dare, Countess, perhaps you have more hair between your legs than I have on my face."
"I have none," she said.
Kildare dared to lean forward and take her hand to his lips. "As they say, my lady, grass does not grow on a well-beaten path." Chapter 45 The bailiff scurried ahead of Blackstone as he forced Kay down the stairs. The bailiff led him past the kitchen where the apothecary was tending to Perrine's wound. Blackstone pushed Cade outside, where survivors of the attack were being held in the courtyard by Blackstone's men. He beckoned John Jacob to accompany him.
"If your friend beds the hall, tell him to make sure there is no knife close to hand," said Cade. "She held a blade at my throat because I accused her of sleeping with a king or his sour-faced son. She's probably been had by everyone at court."
"Keep moving and spare me your thoughts on the Countess. She is of no interest to me." Cade grunted derisively.
"What kind of eunuch are you, Blackstone? Are you telling me you didn't feel the urge to rape her?"
Blackstone ignored the crude taunt as Cade led him down into the dank and musty cellars.
"Where's the Frenchman?"
Cade sniggered.
"Your attack saved him. I was going to geld him. He's there."
Blackstone gripped Cade's collar and moved deeper into the darkness. He reached out and touched the metal frets of a cage. It might have been dog pens or the chateau's cage for holding prisoners. Whatever its purpose, it stank of soiled straw and fetid air. Water ran down the walls, further chilling the atmosphere.
"Allah!" Blackstone called, but there was no reply. "Where is the key?" he asked Cade with a shake of his collar.
Cade looked up at a hook in the wall behind Blackstone. John Jacob took it, opened the cage door, and stepped out of sight into the darkness at the far side of the cage.
"I have him," said John Jacob. "He's more dead than alive."
He grabbed the unconscious young Frenchman beneath his arms. "Get him outside," said Blackstone. And as John Jacob pulled him free, Blackstone pushed Cade into the cage and locked the door.
"You'll stay there until I decide when I'm going to kill you."
Cade pushed himself against the bars.
"Blackstone, you are hunted. The French want you dead. You're a plague on the House of Valois. I was paid to ride with Chandos so that I might kill you, but I decided to take your gold instead. If the Welshman hadn't arrived, I would have found a way to cut your throat in the night. But I decided my chances were better served running without Madoc. I know where he is, and he has the rest of your money. Let me live, and I will tell you where. Let me live, and I will ride away. I don't care what you do with my men. There are always others. But I will stay well away. You have my word. What do you say, Blackstone? Come on. Killing the Welshman will give you more pleasure than killing me."
"Killing both of you would please me more," said Blackstone, and then followed John Jacob. Once they had dragged Alain into the daylight, they saw that he was badly hurt. His leg was twisted at an unnatural angle, and pieces of broken bone pierced the skin. It was matted with dirt and excrement from the foul cage. His face was caked with blood, and one eye was swollen and closed.
"He took a hard blow, Sir Thomas. I can't rouse him. And that leg..."
John Jacob let the words hang. Blackstone nodded. He knew as well as his squire how badly injured the leg was. He saw Perrine being helped from the kitchen. He was weak, but would survive. He shrugged off the helping hands of the men who supported him, cursing at them and getting the usual rough response from his comrades, but the coarse exchange was all in good humour. Blackstone called up to them. "Perrine! Don't tear open the wound. That's an order. You rest. There's enough brandy to give you sleep."
"Aye, Sir Thomas, and the apothecary has given me a tincture for the pain and bandaged me. I'll sleep for a week."
Blackstone beckoned Renfred over from where he stood with his men guarding the captives. The German captain ran to his sworn lord.
"How many of their men do we hold?"
"Near enough, 70.
"Find a stretcher, and have four of them carry this lad to the apothecary's house. I want it done gently, Renfred. We must give him every chance we can. Then use a dozen or more of the garrison men to get rid of those corpses that are hanging in the square. Keep the rest of the prisoners bound and guarded until I know what we're doing next. Where's Moulin?"
"At the town square."
Renfred needed no further orders and ran back, shouting his own commands. The elderly apothecary stepped carefully down the steps to the courtyard.
"I am told you are Sir Thomas Blackstone," said the old man. "I have done all I can for the monk's wound."
"He's no monk, and you will be paid for your skills."
The old man could not hide his surprise.
"I am grateful, my lord. I thought it likely that I would be put to the knife once I had fulfilled my duties."
"Not by me or by my men." "Can you help this lad?" he said. The old healer was gazing down at the unconscious Alain.
"He's alive?"
"Barely."
"Not for much longer."
"Can you save him?"
"That leg is poisoned. Those bones cannot be mended."
He extended his arm for Blackstone's support, which was given, and he knelt next to Alain. After a cursory examination, he took Blackstone's arm again and stood.
"I might help the head wound and the swelling of the eye, but the leg, no." "Impossible, Sir Thomas. You need a barber surgeon."
Renfred appeared with a stretcher and four garrison prisoners.
"I don't have a barber surgeon."
"I have you," said Blackstone.
The bailiff was dismissed to arrange food from the kitchens for Blackstone's men, while the injured Frenchman was taken to the apothecary's house. There were no facilities for surgical operations, so Blackstone swept aside the foodstuff and plates on the kitchen table and had the lad laid on it.
"Old man, you will save this boy. I made a promise to his father that I would cause him no harm, and that means I offered him my protection. Attend to his wounds."
The old man's watery eyes gazed at the broken body that lay unconscious in the kitchen. His hands trembled slightly. These hard-looking men who crowded the small room frightened him, and the towering figure of Thomas Blackstone, taller than the door-frame, and who looked to have the strength of a bull, could snap his neck in a moment's anger should he change his mind and decide that his healing skills were of little use.
"I will try," he said. "Cut free his clothing and fetch me hot water from the fire. Go into that room there."
He pointed, without looking, at the adjoining chamber.
"Find me a linen sheet and tear it into strips this wide."
He spread the palm of his hand. Renfred went in search of the material. The old man looked up at Blackstone.
"You are a scarred man, Sir Thomas, and to my eyes you have been so for many years. Were you grievously wounded?"
"I was, after Cressy. I was a boy."
"And the physician who cared for you? He was a man of great experience?"
"He was."
"Then I beg you, do not compare me to him. I am a humble apothecary. Send one of your men to the corpses that hang in the town square, and bring me maggots. They will be feasting on the dead flesh, and I will use them to feast on this stench in his leg. Trust me in this matter."
"I have used maggots before in wounds," said Blackstone.
"John, go down to the square. Take one of those pots. Do as he asks."
"And these men?"
John Jacob asked, meaning the four prisoners.
"They stay here. We'll need them to hold the boy down."
"We will help you, Sir Thomas,"
said one of the men, grateful to have been spared. Alain stirred The air raised goose flesh on his torso. He started to regain consciousness.
"Lift his head gently. Let him sip this," said the apothecary,
passing Blackstone a small, dark glass bottle.
"Do it, my son. It will ease his pain and cast a shadow over his mind. If we are obliged to take his leg, let us spare him the pain and anguish of it."
Blackstone moved to the awakening young man and gently lifted his head.
"Easy, boy."
Alain de la Grave's uninjured eye opened and stared at the scar-faced knight who bent over him.
"Sir Thomas."
"You're safe," said Blackstone, dribbling the potion into the injured man's lips.
Alain gripped his wrist.
"Cade is here. He beat me."
"I know. We have him. He'll pay."
"And Perrin?"
"Wounded, but alive."
Alain sighed as the potion began its work, and loosened his grip on Blackstone's arm.
"Forgive me, Sir Thomas. I failed you. I could not escape in time and warn you that Cade was here."
"You played your part well," said Blackstone.
"Your father would be proud of you." The young man smiled gratefully, and Blackstone saw that he was drifting away under the effect of the drug. Blackstone made a silent promise that should the boy live, he would tell him the truth about his father, who was the wellspring of his courage.
"Cade beat me, but she betrayed me to him. She gave me to him,"
Anna said almost in a whisper, so gentle that Blackstone had to put his ear close to the boy's lips.
"Who?" asked Blackstone, already knowing the answer, but wanting to hear it from the young man.
"My beautiful countess," said Anna,
a tear easing down his cheek, and then he fell into his drug-induced sleep. Chapter 46 Renfred stayed with the garrison soldiers at the apothecary's house, awaiting John Jacob's return. As Blackstone strode across the courtyard, Moulin came from the opposite direction.
"We are giving William Cade a chance to be fed, and have any injury he has attended to. Go into the cellars, and cut his hands free, and have him secured to the cage bars. Give him a blanket, food and water, no brandy or wine. I want him rested and sober for the morning."
"It would be less trouble if I just cut his throat," said the big Norman.
"No, Moulin. I want him to fight for his life. I promised him a painful death, and he shall have one. But I won't kill a man who is without his strength. See to it."
"Aye, Sir Thomas."
"Have you checked the stables? Warm and dry, and plenty of fodder. Only Cade's men had mounts stabled here. These garrison troops had no need."
"Good.
Pick men to go and bring in our horses. I will have John Jacob fetch my horse. Is everything here secure?"
said Blackstone, scanning the walls, rooftops, and streets.
"We hold the town and the chateau. Will and Jack still have their archers on the walls. The gates have been opened long enough for the villagers to return to their homes. The last of the livestock is going out now, and then the gates will be barred."
"No man is to go anywhere alone. Two men together, no matter how mundane the task, Moulin. We are not welcome here. Let's not gift them a lone target, should anyone seek revenge."
"What are we to do about the prisoners?"
"Once I have the Countess's word that they will not raise their weapons against us, I'll release them. So keep them guarded until then. The bailiff will organize food from the kitchen, but it will take too long to feed us all. Find women in their households to cook, feed our men, and then the prisoners. Pay the women for their effort and food. We don't want them pissing in it."
Moulin gave him a quizzical look.
"There are 70 garrison soldiers. Enough to cause trouble if they take it into their hands to try to take back the town. They'll know every street and alleyway, so we would be hard-pressed."
"The Countess was using Kay to draw in mercenaries and then kill them. The French king has two armies searching out and killing routiers. Chandos clears towns of these skinners, and our own king has promised they would not be used to hinder the treaty."
"What crime has she committed?"
"She has a cruel heart and an appetite for men, but I cannot take this town from her. And even if I desired to, we don't have enough men to stay here and command it. So we will let them go when I have secured her word," said Blackstone, and then, as an afterthought, "for what it's worth."
"Then I will arrange a double guard on the night watch, and have the men stay vigilant.
There's little sense in trusting a woman who entraps men and then inflicts a bad death on them."
He spat into the dirt.
"Even if they are skinners."
Blackstone made his way up to the Countess's rooms. He heard laughter behind the closed doors. The three men who guarded the entrance had been joined by four more. They smiled as Blackstone approached. One of them was the hobbler, Tate.
"What are you doing here, Tate?" "I brought my men inside the walls once the gate was secured. Some of the villagers were already going back to their homes, and when I searched for you, I was told you were here, but Sir Gilbert damn near kicked my ass when I interrupted him. So I thought I would wait here until you returned. I relieved one of the men you had left here at this door." "You did well last night. You drew their attention, and their crossbowmen. Your men are safe?"
"Aye, my lord. It was a simple enough task you gave us."
"Stay here until food is arranged for the men. I have matters to attend to. Do not think that because we hold the town that we are safe. There might be some belligerent townsmen who think they can slip out into a darkened alley and plunge a knife into your neck. The sooner we are done with this place, the better."
"Yes, Sir Thomas, I understand."
"My lads are scavengers. They'll find themselves food, and they won't trust the Pope when walking down an alley, so they'll be wide enough awake for any attack."
"Good. You tell your men that the captains have orders to pay for anything we take. What's happening in there?"
Blackstone asked, as another peal of laughter was heard. Tate shrugged.
"You would think the Countess might be more sorrowful. Her men are dead or captured, her town taken, and she must still wonder whether she herself will come to any harm. Perhaps it is Sir Gilbert's charm that pleases her."
"Then I should have brought one of the scribes from the monastery, so that such an event might be recorded in the history books. Sir Gilbert's charm is best expressed in battle."
"My lord," said Tate, not understanding.
"He has none," Blackstone explained, and then pushed open the doors.
"Thomas! There you are," said Kilbert,
who was sitting on a footstool between Countess Catherine and the fireplace. He had a glow to his face that was not only from sitting close to the warmth of the flames. He grinned foolishly.
"Come, my friend, join us. Our hostess has brandy that would grow hair where there is none," he chortled, glancing at the Countess, who, barely suppressing a smile, fixed her gaze more intently on Blackstone.
Blackstone's grim countenance showed he had no wish to be inveigled into the Countess's hospitality.
"Our hostess is our prisoner. She has no privileges until she proves herself willing to cooperate," he said.
Kilbert stepped to his friend's side and spoke quietly, so that the Countess could not hear.
"Thomas, she is more than willing." He grinned foolishly again. "Has the wine and brandy on an empty stomach addled your brain?" said Blackstone quietly. "Do you know how dangerous this woman might prove to be?"
"I think you should leave her to me. I have a certain finesse in these matters," Kilbert told him. Then, in little more than a whisper, "You do what you have to do, and I will do what needs to be done here." Countess Catherine stared boldly at Blackstone. It was almost like a challenge. It seemed likely that she would desire nothing better than to come between him and his friend. Then she would have won a victory of sorts over him. Blackstone looked past Kilbert.
"You gave a young man to your killer, as a man would toss a dog a bone."
"Alain," she shrugged, "I could do nothing else. I thought he had lied to us. Had I not done so, then who knows what Cade might have done to me? I have men at my shoulder who would die for me, but even they would not have stopped him. I value my life. I have seen what men like Cade are capable of."
"You flit from seasoned killers to innocent young man between your sheets. And then you betray and abandon both."
"I am a woman alone in a violent man's world. I have sworn soldiers at my command. I rule this territory. I am no chattel. I am permitted by law to sign legal documents, to buy and sell land and goods. I am a woman whose husband and family were cruelly slain, and I will not take any lecture from a heathen mercenary like you. I am a countess in the realm of King John. I have authority. Do not dare, sir, to tell me whom I might or might not take to my bed."
She held the glass into the fire, where it flared briefly as the brandy spilled.
Kilbert glanced with raised eyebrows at Blackstone and then slowly released the breath he had held as Blackstone had been berated.
"I'll stay," he said quietly, "and smooth things over."
Blackstone ignored his friend. "Countess, you are confined to these quarters. Once we are secure here, you will command your men not to raise arms against mine. If you do this, then your remaining soldiers will have their weapons returned when we leave." Sufficient men remain to protect you and to hold this town. But you will no longer have men like Cade to draw routiers here to their death. If you refuse to command your men, then they will die.
And when I give this order, if I give this order, and your men have taken whatever you permit them to take,
they will take nothing more than food and drink and fodder for our horses, which we will pay for, interrupted Blackstone.
Very well. And what happens then? Said the Countess.
We leave, Felice, after I kill William Cade. Chapter 47 Blackstone inspected his men's positions, taking Renfred with him. It was obvious that he had too few men to effectively hold the town for any length of time. Townspeople averted their eyes as the two men walked through the narrow streets. The air was still crisp, and he knew that he had been blessed with the dry weather for the attack on the town. The two men made their way down into the open square, where the corpses had been hanging, but had now been removed. Moulin and his men were shepherding some of the garrison prisoners, whose work party carried bundles of faggots and cut timber. The gates were open, and guarded by Will Longdon's men on the walls.
"Sir Thomas, we have too few men to patrol the walls at night, so Will Longdon and I are putting markers out to burn near those village houses," said Moulin. "There's a French army out there only a few days away. If for any reason they decide that they would rather hold this place than us, then we don't want any surprises. The archers will have their distance marked.
Warn the villagers to stay in their homes after curfew. These small towns are not as strict, as they have no police to enforce it," said Blackstone. "Are the horses stabled?"
"John Jacob and his men brought them in.
Take the braziers from the walls and place them in the square. Better that we see anyone within who might try and take us by surprise than for our men on the parapet to be seen by the fires. Cade made the mistake of showing us where his men were." Moulin nodded and turned away to carry out Blackstone's orders.
"Renfred, I want our men to take over the soldiers' billets. Make sure that the cooks know where they are. Have the garrison men locked in one of the buildings before dark once they have been fed. They may only be garrison troops, but they fought well, and there'll be veterans among them. No fighting man likes the taste of defeat, and if they see a chance to strike back at us, then they could seize it. They might have a hidden cache of weapons. Caution is the best defense we have now. Remember, no man walks the streets alone. When that is done, then find me. There is more we need to do to protect ourselves."
Renfred beckoned one of his men to him, and they made their way towards the soldiers' quarters, as Blackstone went up onto the walls. To one side he saw Jack Halfpenny and Quinnell still holding their archers in place. Will Longdon and his men controlled the front wall over the town gate. He saw that Moulin's men were stacking firewood to be lit as beacons, with the veteran archer directing their position.
"How far?"
Will Longdon called to those below.
247, came the answer, as Blackstone joined him.
"Mark!"
cried Will Longdon.
"Thomas,
we can do little more to secure the town. How long do you intend to stay here?"
"All being well, we will leave in a day or so. I would like to find out where the Welshman has gone, but even on pain of death Cade would lie, so it would serve no purpose to torture him."
"I would still take my knife to him if you'd permit it. The bastard's men nearly killed me, and he hanged Peter Garland for the pleasure of it."
"I know, Will. But I'll fight him tomorrow. He'll be dead by the time the church bell rings for midday prayers."
Blackstone let his eyes take in the defences. "As you said, we have done all we can do to secure this place, but something is wrong, I feel it. We are more vulnerable inside these walls than we are out." He watched as Felice's carpenters repaired the roofs he and his men had used to clamber onto the walls. He turned his gaze across the town's buildings and the chateau that towered beyond them.
"There's a woman up there who commands loyalty from these people. She inflicts revenge on routiers, and she still has sworn men who serve her. And to these townspeople, we are nothing more than English mercenaries.
We didn't kill any of them in the attack, and Moulin says that we pay for the food we take. It means nothing to people who hate routiers, and who served her husband and now her. She wields power. She's unafraid, and that makes her dangerous."
Before darkness fell, Blackstone and John Jacob made their way to the apothecary's house. Alain lay strapped to the old man's table, a blanket covering his chest and thighs. His wound had been packed with maggots.
The young Frenchman trembled with fever, and sweat streaked his face and torso.
"I dare not administer any more opiate to him," said the apothecary to Blackstone and John Jacob in the dim candlelit room.
"You have the skill to keep him alive, though."
"Medicine is brought together by astrology, the use of herbs, and the will of God. I have not studied the heavens, and profess to have only a lifetime of skill with the plants and potions at my disposal. I have taken urine from him. His water was green after first being red. It tells me he is infected. I do not see how he can live."
"The colour of a man's piss doesn't kill him," said John Jacob. The old man shrugged.
"I can only tell you what I know."
"And the bones in his leg?" said Blackstone. The old man sighed.
"You have seen wounds like this before?"
he said, exposing the wound more clearly to the candlelight. "Tell me what you see now." The stench was bad enough, and even though the maggots had eaten away much of the dead flesh, Blackstone knew the poison could soon kill the young man. "The leg must go," said Blackstone.
"And it is doubtful he would survive." "I have never seen it done," said the apothecary.
"I have," said Blackstone, "but he'll surely die if we do not cut off the leg."
"I have no skill in this," said the apothecary.
"Send for the town butcher, and have your blacksmith prepare hot pitch. Once the leg is off, what remains needs to be seared." The apothecary scuttled from the room and called a servant to do Blackstone's bidding. Blackstone wrung out a cloth in a bowl of water and bathed Alain's face. He had tried and failed to keep the young man safe.
"I have never seen a man survive this," said John Jacob. "If it were me, I would be happy for you to kill me now."
The apothecary heard.
"You cannot murder a man so injured."
"How many battlefields have you seen?" said Blackstone. "We kill out of mercy as well as out of anger. This boy is one of us. His parents were cruelly slain and butchered by routiers, and I promised his father that no harm would come to him. He has courage. He deserves a chance."
"What you propose is barely a chance," said the apothecary. "The pain that will be inflicted on him is enough to kill him. I do not have enough medicine to help him."
"You have henbane?" said Blackstone. The old man nodded.
"Of course.
Mix henbane and brandy. It will make him unconscious to anything done to him." For a moment the old man looked uncertain.
"How do you know this?"
"I saved a woman once who was thought to be a witch, but she was a healer, and if she were here now she would tell you to do the same thing. His heart is strong enough, and if it isn't, then he will die in his sleep." Alain shuddered as the fever gripped him. Blackstone looked helplessly at the maggot-infested leg of the young man, who had only wanted to prove himself. The apothecary's door opened as the servant brought in the town butcher. The well-fed man sweated from the exertion of hurrying, and while he wheezed, regaining his breath, he gazed at the man strapped to the table. He placed his belt of implements down on a table, licked his lips, and swallowed hard. "You are to take off this man's leg, above the knee. What do you need?" The butcher's eyes widened. The two fighting men frightened him. He stuttered with uncertainty.
A block beneath his leg."
"You've brought a bone-cutting saw and knife?" said Blackstone. The hapless man tugged out a saw and a long, curved-bladed knife. His hands shook uncontrollably as he also tugged free a cleaver from its pouch.
"Mother of God, Sir Thomas, he'll tear more flesh and cause more damage. This isn't a pig's hock."
The sight of the crude instruments and the fear in the butcher's face made it plain that the man would be less than useless if the bone saw jammed, and to hack off the leg with a cleaver was too brutal an act. Blackstone had seen men's legs taken off in less than a minute by barber surgeons on the battlefield. We packed Perrine's wound with honey and had it stitched closed. Perhaps we need to try that before we take the leg.
"And how do we get the bones back inside his leg?" said John Jacob.
Blackstone studied the two sharp pieces that pierced the wound. "Butcher, go back to your house.
"We will call you again if you are needed," he said. "Be quick. There will soon be curfew." The butcher hurriedly gathered his tools and was ushered out. "Rinse out the wound," Blackstone told the apothecary's servant. "Use brandy. Get every maggot out of that wound, and do not touch those broken bones." He looked up at the apothecary. "You have honey here?"
"Some."
"Enough to press into the wound?"
"Yes."
"Get it, and mix the brandy with henbane." The old man and his servant did as Blackstone demanded.
"What do you plan to do?" said John Jacob.
"Whatever I can," said Blackstone.
"Go and fetch Will. Tell him he's to stitch the lad's wound, so he must bring his needle and cord."
"You intend to push back the bones?"
said the apothecary, realizing the only course of action left beyond amputation.
"Very well,"
he turned to his servant.
"I will clean the wound. Mix me eggs and flour."
The servant disappeared into the back of the kitchen and through a door to a larder.
"I will mix a paste that sets and will help hold the leg in place. It is a treatment I have used once. A broken leg has been straightened."
It didn't take long for the wound to be flushed clean of the wriggling maggots, and for the cup of sleeping draught to be eased between Alain's lips. Blackstone instructed the apothecary to tear strips of linen sheet into bandages. By the time Will Longdon arrived, Alain was asleep. The wound looked raw, and the broken bones appeared to be more prominent now that much of the dead flesh had been reduced. The apothecary smeared honey into the wound.
"I can't stitch that," said Longdon.
"You've got the cord?"
"Aye. Silk from an arrow fletching. Get it ready."
Whatever Blackstone had planned, Longdon knew better than to argue. He threaded the silk in a curved needle that resembled a sailmaker's awl, and then dipped the silken cord into the brandy flask. Blackstone stood at the side of the table and placed his hands gently either side of the protruding bones.
"Well, stand opposite me. I will push the bones back together in his leg. I'll hold until you stitch each side. John, you and the old man will bind the leg with the bandage. Ready?"
The men nodded. Blackstone repositioned his hands slightly, gazed at the shattered bones, and tried to imagine how they might fit together. It was not the same calculation as laying a dry stone wall, or finding how each piece of rock might fit neatly together for strength, but there was a part of him that instinctively saw how it should be done. And then he pressed down. They heard a crunch and a grinding sound, and Blackstone was momentarily surprised how much resistance there was to pushing the bones back into the leg. The young man's leg muscles were as tight as a bow cord.
"John, take hold of his foot and pull on his leg."
The bones chafed together and submerged into the open wound.
"Now," said Blackstone.
Will Longdon bent to the task and quickly made long looping stitches to close the wound, and then doubled the silk cord back to tie the skin together in smaller stitches, as Blackstone shifted the weight of his hands to accommodate him. When Longdon had finished and cut the cord, Blackstone kept his hands in place, holding the leg straight with his weight. The apothecary's servant placed a deep bowl on the table. The sticky mass it held was almost firm to the touch. The apothecary smeared the thick plaster mixture over the leg and, when satisfied, instructed what to do next.
"Bind the leg tightly, top to bottom,"
he told John Jacob. When the task was completed, the men stood back and looked at the sleeping young Frenchman.
"My servant will sit with him throughout the night," said the apothecary. "If he is still alive in the morning, then, well, then we will see. He is in God's hands now."
Blackstone and his two companions stepped out into the last remnants of daylight. The church bell rang for vespers, but the streets were deserted. The clear evening settled into near darkness. A dog barked somewhere, answered by another. The braziers were already lit in the town's main square. Blackstone knew his men were tired. He felt it himself, but they needed to be alert this night. He imagined himself to be one of the townsmen, or a survivor from the fight. If he were going to strike an enemy who had taken his town, he would wait until the attacker's exhaustion claimed them. Blackstone's men had ridden from the monastery, fought Cade's men, and then assaulted the town the previous day and night. They all needed sleep. Will, John and I will walk you back to your post, and then we will find a place to keep watch ourselves. As they turned into the main square, the bell stopped ringing, and an eerie silence settled over the town of Felice. What was it that made Blackstone's skin crawl? He was no stranger to sensing the spirits of the dead. There had been much cruelty in the town, and its very name had spawned a woman heedless of the suffering she caused, a woman who took delight in seeing men die slowly at her command. Shadows from the braziers might easily be ghosts, haunting the dark alleyways, beckoning the living to join them. "If they come, they will come tonight," he said quietly. But he was uncertain if he meant the living or the dead. Chapter 48 Kilbert had eaten well from the food supplied from the kitchen for him and the Countess. They had teased and tempted one another with innuendo and at times outright suggestive talk. This woman, who enjoyed the pleasures of men at any time of her choosing, kept Kilbert's lust simmering. They had both drunk too much by the time the bell rang for night prayers, 3 hours after Vespers. The candles flickered in pools of wax. Only the fire that Kilbert had fed from the faggots and logs during the day gave the room sufficient light for him to see the Countess's features. He risked her anger by lifting the sleeve on her dress and exposing her arms. It was a flagrant breach of etiquette that might have earned him a cuff around the head, but she had pressed herself back into her chair and luxuriated in his touch. He stroked her bare skin with the back of his hand, keeping the roughness of his palm and fingers away from her silken limb. Her eyes half closed.
"It is late," she said sleepily. "It is time for bed."
He kissed the palm of her hand and gently bit the raised part at the base of her thumb, the Mount of Venus. She pulled away.
"I did not give you permission," she said without any malice.
"I did not need it, my Lady Catherine." Kilbert stood and offered his hand. She took it and raised herself so that she stood close to him. Kilbert made no move towards her. She raised her eyebrows.
"You do not desire me,"
he smiled. "To go further, I need permission."
"And to bathe."
She stepped away towards her bedchamber's door and then turned back.
"Though I do not find your smell disagreeable."
"It is honest sweat, my lady," said Kilbert. She murmured a soft mewling sound and shrugged.
"Permission is given."
She walked past the two stoic bodyguards who had waited against the far wall. Neither man glanced at her or looked at Kilbert as he picked up his sword belt wrapped around its scabbard. "Don't be alarmed if you hear her cry out," he said as he passed them, and then closed the bedroom door behind him. The sweet scent of beeswax candles mingled with her own fragrance. The room was heavy with desire as they faced each other and undressed in a slow dance of sensuality as each piece of clothing dropped to the floor. When she was naked, she lay half-propped on her bed and watched as he sluiced the dirt and sweat from his body with water from the bowl on her nightstand. By the time he had dried himself, he was aroused, and as he approached the bed, he nipped the candle wicks until only two remained, bathing her body in a gossamer of shadow and light. As the hours passed, there was nothing gentle about their coupling, and she fought him with a passion that matched his own. When they were spent, they fell back into the softness of the feather mattress and rested, and then began again, until finally the wine and exertion claimed them both. Kilbert was barely awake and close to succumbing to his own exhaustion. As his eyes grew heavy, he laughed aloud. The beautiful and sensuous woman beside him curled her body in slumber and snored like a grunting soldier. Darkness cloaked the room. The faintest glimmer from the night sky barely showed their shapes in the bed. The dull ringing of the church bell for night prayers echoed across the rooftops. It was midnight, and the killing began. Silent men, their boots bound with rags to dull the sound of their footsteps, scurried like rats through the darkened streets. They were townsmen, who would march as militia in support of the garrison troops when called to war.
They were sullen, belligerent men who hated the English and their victory over King John. The traitor William Cade served a purpose for the Countess, and whatever sins he had committed as a routier were forgiven when he delivered mercenaries into her hands. 40 men had answered the call of the Countess's bailiff, men who kept their weapons hidden under floorboards in their homes, men who were urged by their women to kill the invaders who had spilled blood on the streets. It made no difference to them that they had been spared rape and death by a benevolent Englishman. Years of bitterness fueled the hatred coursing through them. They had used their knowledge of the labyrinthine vaults that lay beneath the chateau and released William Cade from his cell. Cade forgot any thoughts of escape now that the citizens of Felice had risen up. There was still a handful of Cade's men imprisoned, and they were released by the blacksmith, who opened the lock that secured their prison. They were soon armed and took command of the townsmen. They would overwhelm Sir Thomas Blackstone's men. William Cade knew exactly how to defeat Blackstone's outnumbered troop. Whispered commands passed from man to man as they approached the town square. An attack of two columns, each down a side street, left and right, who would storm the walls and kill the archers first. Once their threat had been removed, half of the force who had remained in the courtyard near the chateau would kill Blackstone's men who were billeted nearby. Then those of Blackstone's men who remained would be caught between those who attacked from the town square and others who would act like beaters on a day's hunt and drive Blackstone's men onto the attackers' swords. Cade would once again take his place in the whore's bed. He cursed. The damned bell kept clanging. It would wake the dead. The tolling of the hour was also an arranged call to arms, but the idiot on the end of the rope needed to stop before its insistence awoke Blackstone's men sooner than was needed. He turned to one of the townsmen who ran at his side. "The church! Tell them to stop!" The man grunted an answer and turned away. Despite the darkness, he knew exactly which side street led to the church. Hadn't he been born and raised in Felice, and never left except to help kill those who threatened the valley? He'd known the old count, had carted wood up to the chateau, still did, since he was a boy of 7 with his father. The long-handled axe he carried would be cutting down more than trees this night. He slowed, placed a rough palm on the stone wall that he knew would guide him into the square, and the church, where the slow-witted Marcel would be heaving on the rope. He was soon across the open ground and pushing into the ancient church. A candle burned near the figure who heaved on the rope. A bundle of clothing lay on the stone floor near the bell-ringer. It meant nothing.
"Marcel! Cade says to stop, damn you!"
The man let go of the rope, but by the time he turned, the axeman had realized that they were not rags that littered the dark floor. He swung back his axe. The bell-ringer seemed to move so quickly that by the time the axeman was ready to strike, the man was an arm's length from him, and the sudden pain in his heart pierced the darkness of the church as a lightning bolt seared through his brain. Renfred stepped over the dead woodsman. Everything that Blackstone had predicted was already taking place. William Cade led the mixed force of garrison troops and militia into the town square past the gallows, as the garrison sergeant-at-arms, with his men who had been released, pounded into the far side from the other street. A wind had picked up, funneled along the valley and striking the village and walled town. It smelled of rain, a gathering storm that would soon hurl itself against those who fought in the narrow confines of Felice. Men would falter once the rain chilled their muscles, but if luck was on their side, they would beat the storm before it reached them. Cinders and sparks flew from the braziers in the square as the wind whipped their flames. Cade gestured left and right for the men to scale the steps that led up to the walkway. The crenellations obscured any archer's silhouette against the night sky, but as his men ran along the walls there was no sound of assault. No body fell, no man cried out. Cade stopped beneath the gallows. Men broke the silence and shouted that the walls had been abandoned. It made no sense to the mercenary. Would Blackstone have stood down his prized archers from guarding the walls? Were they sleeping? Did he think that walls did not need defending? Before he could satisfy himself with an answer, he heard the sudden clash of a fight near the chateau. Men's voices were raised in fear and anger. What had happened? If the other half of his force had trapped Blackstone's men between them, then his plan had worked. No matter that the archers were not at their posts, perhaps they already lay dead in their beds, betrayed by the cooks like the rest of Blackstone's men. In his mind's eye he saw that those of Blackstone's troop, who had survived being knifed in their beds, were now trapped beneath the chateau's walls.
"Turn back!"
he bellowed.
"The courtyard! We have them!"
It was time to kill the scar-faced knight and claim the glory and the reward of the French king and the gratitude of the Countess, who by now would have killed Sir Gilbert Kilbert. Chapter 49 Countess Catherine had allowed herself to sleep after the vigorous love-making with the veteran knight. He had shown no lack of stamina, and she concluded that the gratification that she had received had been worth the time she had spent drawing in this man, who was clearly senior to Blackstone, and who would have taken control of her town. Keeping Kilbert in her quarters had left the younger Englishman to organize his men, and from what the veteran told her over the hours that he had sat at her feet by the fireside, Blackstone was doing only what Kilbert had instructed. Blackstone was a man who yearned for command, but whom Kilbert kept in check. When the veteran knight had left the room to relieve himself, in the garderobe, she had instructed her bailiff, and the two bodyguards went to strike. As the night bell rang, she opened her eyes and then nudged her back against the weight of the man lying next to her. He did not awake. She counted the first 10 chimes, so that her mind was clear, and then, easing her dagger from beneath the mattress, rolled quickly, plunging its blade into where Kilbert's head would rest on the pillow next to her. The moment the knife struck home, she cried out. No gristle or bone met the blade, only a pillow. His body had been replaced with a heavy bolster. Kneeling up, breasts free from the entwining sheet, her mouth gaped as the doors burst open. The outer room's fire glow threw the heavy shadows of the two armed bodyguards over her, as a naked man stepped behind the first man and plunged a sword between his shoulder blades. When he fell, the second man turned, but the quick-moving Kilbert had a dagger in his other hand that swept upwards, catching the man in the throat. He went down, hands clutching his gurgling wound. The shock of the attack and her failure to kill Kilbert momentarily stunned her. Kilbert, ignoring the dead men, stepped quickly towards her, and she recovered. She spat at him and screamed a curse, jabbing with the knife. He easily stepped aside and swung his blood-smeared hand across the side of her head. She fell heavily. Kilbert threw her knife far enough away and strode through to the other room, where Tate and his men were trying to force the door that had been barricaded by the bodyguards. He tossed aside the heavy chair and pulled away the table that had been pushed beneath the door handles. He opened the doors. Tate and his men gawped at the naked figure of Sir Gilbert Kilbert in the firelight, blood-stained sword in hand.
"Don't just stand there looking like a damned virgin who's seen her first cock. Get down to the fight!" he barked.
At the top of the town, Blackstone stood with John Jacob, Moulin and Renfred and their men, backs against the high walls at the base of the chateau. In front of them lay 20 or more dead or dying militia and garrison troops. Earlier, during curfew, Blackstone's men had moved away from their billet. They had waited silently, unmoving in the blackness, watching the militia gathering their force, releasing the garrison troops, and hurriedly and quietly organizing their strike into the town. While Blackstone and his men knelt behind their shields, merging their dark forms into the depth of the archways that spanned the base of the walls, the town force had split into two, and the garrison men had gone quickly into the billet to kill. They had swiftly emerged again, uncertain and disorganized, after finding the room empty, and been instantly attacked by Moulin and his men from one angle, and Blackstone head-on. They had raised no battle cry. It was the garrison men who bellowed in fear. They fought where they stood, and died. There looked to be more than 100 garrison soldiers and town militia who tried to fight their way clear. 4 of Moulin's men fell, a slight cost because of the efficiency of their killing. After the sudden impact of his surprise attack, Blackstone had retreated with the men back to the wall, where they braced themselves for the counterattack that would soon come once the survivors had gathered themselves. Blackstone had chosen his ground and put all of his men in one killing area. The smaller courtyard beneath the chateau's walls favoured his outnumbered men. It obliged the greater force to funnel into a tight arena where they could be contained and slain.
Men would jostle each other, trying to reach Blackstone's men. Their ability to fight effectively would be diminished. Will Longdon, Halfpenny and Quinnell stood unseen above the men in the yard, having earlier run from the walls onto the road that curved high up to the chateau, which eventually became the vast terrace that looked down across the town. From there, the archers had watched that first conflict below, as Blackstone and his men seemed to appear from nowhere to kill the unsuspecting Felice troops. William Cade pushed his way into the disordered men as they jostled at the mouth of the courtyard.
"Move forward! Forward!" he yelled.
He addressed two of his men close by, who had fought in the confined space.
"What's happened? Where's Blackstone?"
The men turned contorted faces on him.
"We should get out while we can,"
one of them said, trying to push past Cade, who snatched at him. Cade's grip and ferocious snarl were sufficient to stop the panicked routier.
"What's happened here? I ask again, where is Blackstone?"
"His men are back against the wall. We can't see them. There aren't that many, but—"
"We outnumber them,"
Cade spat.
"Aye, but we have garrison troops and militia at our backs," the man bleated.
"With me,"
Cade insisted, as he shouldered his way through the gaggle of men into the courtyard. Too frightened to disobey, the man and his companion turned back with Cade. Cade edged closer to the perimeter of the courtyard. It was so dark he could only make out that the dark lumps on the ground were men's bodies.
"If their men have their backs against the wall, then they have no escape. We have blocked the streets down into the town. They are caught like rats in a trap."
"Aye, but not one man here wants to go forward into the dark."
"Then fetch torches," said Cade.
He shouted to the gaggle of men that choked the entrances to the streets.
"Fetch torches!"
Men pushed their way into houses and soon re-emerged, carrying lanterns and flaming reed bundles. Cade snatched one of the torches and stepped forward. He took a few more tentative steps, the flames held high, allowing him to see the dead. Beyond them, backs pressed against the arched wall, Blackstone's men's dismembered faces glared at him like gargoyles from above their shields. Cade turned back to the ranks of men who waited ready to attack.
"See how few they are. They have no escape. Take back your town. Kill these men and hang their bodies for the crows."
Encouraged by how few men faced them, the militia and garrison troops raised their voices and their weapons. Their ragged line surged forward, jumping and stumbling over their dead in the flickering torchlight. Blackstone's men did not move. A savage cry rose up from the attackers. They would slaughter Blackstone's men where they stood. As they reached halfway across the courtyard, a different sound came from the darkness above, a rippling of the air, whose significance could not be determined by those who heard it above the cacophony. A sudden and terrifying force struck them down. A mighty hand had hurled a death storm of bodkin-tipped arrows into them, tearing flesh and muscle, felling a score of men who writhed among the abandoned torches that sparked and spluttered as men's bodies rolled across them in their death throes. Screams rent the night air as another flight of arrows whispered and hit with a sickening thud. Cade had crouched, then fallen, as arrows found their mark in men next to him. An arrow struck the ground close by, its impact making the yard-long shaft quiver. Cade scrambled to his knees as Blackstone's men suddenly ran forward into the disarray. Cade's mind raced through his fear. Every man that Blackstone had under his command was either in this courtyard or on the terrace above them. If the townsmen retreated, they would be pursued, but there was still enough of them to slow Blackstone's men, and that would give him time to escape. Two of his own men had survived. Wide-eyed with fear, they too crouched, using the dead as shields.
"The stables!"
Cade shouted to them. Kildare had bound the unconscious countess with torn sheets and locked her bedchamber door, then hurriedly dressed and run down to where Tate and his men stood at the main door, where Perrine held his post. The injured man wore only breeches and a shirt, its linen cloth stained from his unhealed back wound. There seemed little chance that the townsmen would attack up the snaking roadway, now that the archers had slain so many. Kildare glanced at Perrine.
"Where's Sir Thomas?"
"Below, in the yard."
"Perrine, stay here, guard the stairs. There'll be no assault on the chateau,
with Will's men here, but if you see the bailiff, you hold him. He's not to go up to the Countess. Tate, you and your